At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president said tonight everything's going to be all right, that he's got a plan to fix the economy. All he needs now is a little bit of time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution by carrying the load of 280 trucks by rail. CSX, how tomorrow moves.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 24th of March. It's Tuesday, and it is good to have you with us. It's been 6 weeks, give or take, since President Obama's last primetime press conference. Since then, the Dow has gone farther down, back up some. AIG bonuses have been paid out, reclaimed in part. His Treasury Secretary has shared the details of the bank bailout with us. There's a budget being debated on Capitol Hill, and sooner or later we're going to get new rules for Wall Street to live by, too. So the president took to the podium this evening with plenty to talk about. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is with us to talk about what the president was talking about. Hiya, John.
Hello, Kai.
This was the bully pulpit, right, trying to sell that economic plan?
Yeah, and he's having a tough time, partly because of the sheer complexity of this problem. You know, there's no easy way to explain what's going on so many fronts with this financial gridlock, banks not lending, homes being foreclosed. So in his opening statement, the president acknowledged that there are no silver bullets to solve this.
We'll recover from this recession, but it will take time, it will take patience, and it will take an understanding that when we all work together, when each of us looks beyond our own short-term interests to the wider set of obligations we have towards each other, that's when we succeed. That's when we prosper. And that's what is needed right now.
And that led right to the first question, John, which actually was about Secretary Geithner and the chairman of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, today up on Capitol Hill, asking for new rules on how to keep an eye on the banking system.
That's right. They want these sweeping powers to have the government take over non-bank financial firms, insurance companies, hedge funds, the same way the FDIC takes over failing banks. That's being called a major power grab by government, by some of the Republicans up on the Hill. But the president defended that plan today.
I think that there's going to be strong support from the American people and from Congress to provide that authority so that we don't find ourselves in a situation where we've got to choose between either allowing an enormous institution like AIG, which is not just insuring other banks, but is also insuring pension funds and potentially putting people's 401ks at risk if it goes under. That's one choice. And then the other choice is just to allow them to take taxpayer money without the kind of conditions that we'd like to see on it.
And there will, in fact, be more hearings on that later this week on Capitol Hill and in weeks to come, I'm sure. John, I want to get back to the idea that the president has to convince the American public of the soundness of his plan. He also talked tonight about his budget, and he said it was inseparable from the recovery plan.
Yeah, it's a huge, ambitious increase in spending with all sorts of new initiatives, health care, education, energy. And that's why even moderate Democrats are beginning to balk at all the spending. They're recommending rolling back some of this, some of the more ambitious goals like cap and trade emission credits for greenhouse gases. The Congressional Budget Office says he's creating deficits, the president's budget is creating deficits that are 25% higher than what the White House is anticipating. President Obama said today that that's because he's estimating faster growth in the out years of the 10-year budget.
Here's what I do know. If we don't tackle energy, if we don't improve our education system, if we don't drive down the costs of health care, if we're not making serious investments in science and technology and our infrastructure, then we won't grow 2.6%, we won't grow 2.2%. We won't grow.
And we'll get a look at what the actual growth figures were for the fourth quarter of last year in a couple of weeks. Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kai.
Changing gears now, home values are down again. That's the latest word from the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the government's home loan regulator. It says housing prices fell 6.3% nationwide. That's year over year from last January to this one. But if you make it a monthly comparison from December to January, the housing market actually rose 1.7%. So is that glass half empty or is it half full? We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to help us figure it out.
What appears to be happening is that the housing slowdown is itself slowing down. Falling interest rates are bringing buyers back, and that's offsetting the drag on prices from all the foreclosures on the market. Today's report shows some places, the Northeast and Midwest, are already heading out of the slump. This morning, realtor Joanna Gettinger was showing a house in Ithaca, New York. It's a three-bedroom priced at $245,000.
When a house is priced well and in good condition, or certainly like this house, totally renovated, people will rush toward it. There is a pent-up demand.
Gettinger says this house will probably sell with multiple offers in a matter of days. But that's not happening everywhere. The clients Gettinger was showing around in Ithaca, she says they just sold their house in Portland, Oregon. They only owned it for 6 months and took a 4% loss. And they can consider themselves lucky.
There are certain other suburban markets where you've seen prices down 30-35% or more.
Bob Ullery has been a broker in Portland for 17 years. He says the problem in these neighborhoods isn't foreclosures, but corporate layoffs and relocations as the economy churns.
You have an oversupply, a huge oversupply of expensive homes come on the market, and you don't have enough buyers out there for them. And so how do you fix it? You keep lowering the price until you finally get a buyer. It's just as ugly as that.
Which is what's happening across the West, especially in Arizona, Nevada, and California, where home prices are still declining as the speculative bubble deflates. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Judging by the equity markets today, euphoria over the Treasury's plan to help banks unload their bad assets is beginning to wear off. Stocks gave back some of yesterday's rally. But assuming Secretary Geithner's proposal does get going, we will eventually get a much closer look at banks' balance sheets. They won't be able to claim they can't price those bad assets. That's been the complaint for a year and a half now. And so they will find it much more difficult to avoid writing those assets down, actually forcing banks to fess up to their liabilities. And that, in turn, could leave some weaker lenders in an awkward position, as Ashley Meltite reports.
The auctions are meant to help banks sell some of their troubled assets and take some weight off their books. The program is voluntary. But banking consultant Bert Ely says he's hearing hints the government may lean on banks to participate.
It reminds me of when I was in the Army. Soldier, you will volunteer to do X, Y, or Z, and therefore you volunteered.
So what happens if a bank decides, or is persuaded, to put certain securities on the block, but thinks the offers are too low? Jos Warso is Senior Vice President of Union Bank.
If the price isn't attractive enough for the banks, they're not going to sell. If the price isn't attractive enough for these private entities to buy, they're not going to invest. So that's going to be where the rubber hits the road, obviously.
Even if the auction doesn't result in a sale, it will still provide a benchmark price for the security. Banks might not like that price, but it'll be hard for them to argue, as they sometimes do now, that they can't value their assets accurately. But Ely says the mere presence of a benchmark price could force the banks to write those assets down, and that could have some unwelcome consequences.
If they get indications that they need to mark certain loans down more, that's going to reduce their capital, and that will in turn reduce their lending capacity.
The government might not like that much. The whole idea of the plan is to get banks lending again. Bank shareholders could be disappointed too. Heavy write-downs will probably mean falling stock prices. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Speaking of falling stock prices, it wasn't a big dip on Wall Street today, just enough to take the edge off yesterday's high. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been paying for the bailout and the stimulus two different ways. One, by the Fed printing more money, and two, by the Treasury Department selling more T-bills. The limitations of that strategy became clearer this morning thanks to the Chinese Central Bank. a proposal from them to swap out the dollar as the global reserve currency and eventually replace it with something controlled by the International Monetary Fund. Beijing holds more foreign reserves than any other country does. American greenbacks make up more than half of their $2 trillion stash, which makes them acutely aware of the value of a dollar. But it is still going to be difficult to change the currency status quo, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
The Chinese proposal comes just a week after Russia floated a similar idea. This morning, Republican Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann asked Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner what they thought of it.
Would you categorically renounce the United States moving away from the dollar and going to a global currency as suggested this morning by China and also by Russia, Mr. Secretary?
I would, yes.
You would categorically, and the Federal Reserve Chair?
I would also.
That's important because the U.S. can veto policy decisions at the IMF. Plus, says Mark Chandler, head of currency strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman.
Watch what the Chinese do, not what they say. And here's what they've done. In the second half of last year, the Chinese increased their treasury holdings by 38%.
Chandler and other currency strategists say China wants to flex its economic muscle. But to create a new global currency, China would have to talk other countries into using it. Good luck, says international economist Robert Scott at the Economic Policy Institute.
There are hundreds of billions of dollars worth of $100 bills in circulation in places around the world like Russia and Kazakhstan, where these are the accepted forms of currency. So you would have to replace all that currency, and that's not a trivial matter.
And experts say the dollar's success isn't just because of the economy it represents. There's a lot of military might backing that dollar, too. That is something an international currency without a country behind it wouldn't have. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Here's a question that businesses big and small are trying to get their minds around in the middle of a worldwide recession. How much stuff should you keep on your shelves? It's hard to know, right? Because if you have too much, you're paying for inventory nobody's in the mood to buy. But if you don't have enough, you'll miss whatever consumers there are. And so, just like that, the not-so-sexy world of inventory management has become critical. A lot of big consumer electronics companies have turned to a global supply master, but he's not in Silicon Valley or down in Austin, Texas. Marketplace's Scott Tong tells us about him from Shenzhen, China.
Say you buy a new gadget online. You pick your digital toy, punch in your credit card number, hit enter, and 48 hours later, it's there. Inside that 48 hours stands Liam Casey. He's an Irish entrepreneur in China who likes to quote American Tom Friedman on globalization.
The world is flat but full of details, and we focus on that piece in the middle.
Casey came to this region without a job 13 years ago. He attended an export trade fair, made some contacts, and started to climb the ladder. Today, his company PCH works for big American electronics firms. He's not allowed to name them, but they make the music players and routers and GPS devices you know. These big brands think up the products, but they offload to Casey the dealing with the factories, the shipping, the quality checking, what folks in the trade call logistics.
We take all of that operations that they don't want to do, and that's what we manage for them, and we do that very well.
Here's how. When you, the shopper, order, say, a custom laptop, within minutes, Casey's folks in China get to work.
Then it's tested, and at the top of the line here, you'll see it's going to be packed out with the customized accessories.
I.e., they load the software you asked for.
So it comes in vanilla, and then we flavor it through the process.
Then his workers pack it in a box, and your custom-built machine is on the way. It's all hyper-computerized.
This one here, Farmington Hills, Michigan.
Casey pulls up one order on the screen.
That was at 8:36, just over 4 hours ago.
Okay, so 4 hours ago, and it says shipped. It's already shipped?
Already on its way to Hong Kong. That's going to be on a plane this afternoon to the U.S.
China is just one piece of this picture. Taiwan and Korea make the computer chips and the other electronic innards. Ireland does customer service, and geeks in South Africa write the software to make it all go. By the way, the American brand whose logo is on the thing, it keeps most of the profit. Throughout this supply chain, no opportunity to trim costs is missed. There are no slumbering warehouses, no long pipelines of inventory.
Which creates excess. This probably is one of the leanest supply chains in the whole consumer electronics world.
Now, Liam Casey didn't invent lean manufacturing, but he's thriving in this recession. Calls are up, outsourcing is up.
Companies in the past would have wanted to do it themselves. Now they have a headcount freeze or headcount reduction, whatever, and they say to us, look, can you do the whole product for us?
Casey's story is a bit like China's story in general. He started out as a factory supplier at the bottom of the food chain, and eventually multinational companies gave him more responsibility. Now they also want his ideas. They love him for his brain. Increasingly, Casey and his staff help design products.
Here's leather, wool, natural canvas, again, buffalo leather, suede.
Like this new phone pouch for a big American cell phone company. Liam Casey is versatile. His business model evolves as rapidly as global business does. That way, even in the middle of a vicious economic downturn, he's one middle man you can't cut out. In Shenzhen, southern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
How you feel about the economy right now might well depend on where you are in the pecking order, generationally speaking. To use a personal finance term here for a second, financial horizons, that is, the time any given person has left to work and save, can vary widely. And in light of the great stock market crash of 08, everybody is reassessing their economic future, including commentator Dan Dresner.
The financial downturn has left all sorts of casualties in its wake. More unemployment, depressed wages, and greater economic uncertainty. But I'd like to direct my angst at a different target, the baby boomers. A hidden effect of this crisis is that in the workplace, as in popular discourse, they simply refuse to get out of the way. To understand my lament, you have to realize that the oldest of the baby boomers are on the cusp of retirement. For younger generations, this should be a cause for relief. For decades, Gen Xers like myself have had to hear the standard declarations about the uniqueness of the baby boomers. Maybe they were not the greatest generation, but they were the ones who glorified the whole idea of generational identity. For decades, Gen Xers have had to hear complaints about our political apathy, our popular culture, and our musical tastes. We have suffered many of these critiques without complaint. Why? Because so many of us worked for so many of them. They were the bosses of the business world, and they were supposed to be retiring very soon. But the recession has changed all that. In 2008, U.S. workers aged 55 to 64 who had 401ks for at least 20 years saw their retirement balances drop an average of 20%. A recent YouGov poll showed two-thirds of this generation have not made the necessary adjustments in their financial planning. This is not a recipe for leaving the workforce anytime soon. What does this mean for the rest of us? Younger workers who expected promotions when the boomers cleared out are going to have to stew in their own juices. With this job market, looking for a better opportunity elsewhere is not in the cards, which means that Gen Xers are going to have to listen to baby boomers do what they do best, talk about themselves. Office politics across the country are going to get a lot nastier. Of course, it could be worse. Generation Y not only has to deal with the boomers, they have to cope with people like me complaining about them.
Dan Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. I'm guessing there's going to be some comments on that commentary. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, how your dry cleaner knows there's a recession.
It's obvious to me that there are different stains from different wearings. Sometimes you'll see one type of stain on one part of the garment and another kind of stain somewhere else.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 1.5% today, 115 points, closed at 7,660. The Nasdaq flopped 2.3%, 37 points, finished at 1518. The S&P 500 slid 2%, 16 points, ended the day at 806. Just as the banks led the way up yesterday, they took us down today. Bank of America fell 7%. J.P. Morgan Chase dropped 8%. Wells Fargo slid 10%. CBS picked off a 1% gain on good March Madness ratings numbers, while Time Warner lost 1%. Kitchen goods retailer Williams-Sonoma whisked up 1.3%. Despite reporting a sharp fall in profits, analysts said the company did better than they expected in the quarter. Home furnishing store Pier 1 climbed 37% today.
Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. And by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, a smart way to reach your customers. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in Marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis. From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for February. The Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee holds a hearing on increased violence along the U.S.-Mexico border. And the TV show Cagney and Lacey premiered on March 25, 1982. The crime drama shook up the norm, placing two female detectives in lead roles. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
It's tough to tell exactly who listens to this program, but it's entirely possible there are a bunch of AIG executives out there tuning in. As we now know, 15 of the top 20 recipients of those infamous bonuses have agreed to give the money back. Last week, though, it was a very different story. And if our inbox is any indication, Americans were, and probably still are, outraged. Greg Ahrensing from Corte Madera, California, offered one idea for how to pay up as the contracts seemed to require, but still satisfy the irate taxpayer.
Public shame. Cut the checks. Set up a table in Times Square and announce that recipients can come by and pick up their checks in public on Saturday afternoon, if they dare.
Rob Woods from Willis, Virginia, sees the story a different way.
I find it interesting that everyone's in a tizzy about the $165 million in bonuses that AIG handed out. Citizens, through taxes, have given them approximately $170 billion. That's over 1,000 times as much as the bonus payments. It would be like borrowing $10 from a family member and then getting all upset over how one penny of that money was spent.
Our senior correspondent Bob Moon did a piece last week on the securitization industry. Those are the folks who bundle up mortgages and other loans and sell them off by the slice. Garrett Lowe of San Diego, California, voted no on the question Bob's piece posed, whether the industry ought to rise again.
Clearly, the securitization folks don't get it. Don't they realize that all of the over-leveraging of our financial system only created a house of cards that we're currently seeing tumble before our eyes?
It's not all gloom and doom, even though sometimes it feels like it is. Economist Justin Wolfers did a commentary for us recently where he pondered different names for this thing that's happening to the economy. He offered the flump. We asked for your ideas, and in no particular order, we got the soft depression, the great reality check, the great comeuppance, and a combination of depression and recession, the decession. Keep them coming no matter what they are. You can send us your suggestions, etymological or otherwise. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. It's important to be presentable, to be nicely dressed in a professional environment. But it turns out not only do your clothes say a lot about you, they say a lot about the economy as well. From Boston, Beth Titel reports.
Months ago, the head of a big dry cleaner outside of Boston noticed a change in the condition of the clothes coming into his stores. The rings around the collar were darker, the wrinkles more pronounced.
I've been noticing more on certain areas of the clothes, like behind the knees and behind the elbows.
That's Arthur Anton Jr., Chief Operating Officer of Anton's Cleaners.
It's obvious to me that there are different stains from different wearings. Sometimes you'll see one type of stain on one part of the garment and another kind of stain somewhere else.
As a struggling nation tries to eke extra wearings out of garments before they're dry cleaned, a new economic indicator has emerged, the Crumple Index. It's the cleaning version of that flu tracking tool by Google, which can detect flu activity before the Centers for Disease Control. Indeed, last July, months before the National Bureau of Economic Research declared a recession, the head of another big dry cleaner predicted the economy was headed for trouble. And with almost one-third of households using dry cleaners, Krista Haggerty should know.
We started noticing that the customers were taking longer to pick up their clothes.
Krista Haggerty is president of Dependable Cleaners in the Boston area. She says the average pickup time jumped from 5 days to almost 10. That's bad for the wardrobe and bad for dry cleaners. They don't get paid until the clothing's retrieved. So
we worked with our managers, and they called all of their customers and gave friendly reminder calls.
Well, the calls started out friendly.
If they don't come in within 45 days, the chance of them coming in to pick it up is slimmer.
But the economy is no laughing matter for dry cleaners. Mary Scalco is senior vice president of the Dry Cleaning and Laundry Institute. The group's members report a drop in business by as much as 30% as people trade work suits for sweatsuits and delay bringing in clothing. But here's the rub.
You think that you're saving money by stretching out your visits. But what happens is if you can't get the stains out, or if you're actually doing detriment to the garment, that you've overstretched it, that you can't get it back in shape, it's not going to look the same after you wear it, you wind up needing to buy a new piece of clothing, which actually costs you more money than if you paid for the dry cleaning in between.
In other words, you get taken to the cleaners either way. In Boston, this is Beth Tytel for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, here's the song of the day.
Hey, Paul Krugman, why aren't you in the administration?
Confirmation that everybody's dealing with this recession the best way they know how. It's a guy named Jonathan Mann, and a little number I found online this morning that he calls Hey Paul Krugman, a lament that Krugman doesn't have Tim Geithner's job.
Since everything's been happening, I've been reading and watching and listening as much as I can. And of course, the more I read and listen and watch, the sort of more freaked out I get.
For God's sakes, man, you won the Nobel Prize. Timothy Geithner uses TurboTax.
Check it out on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Hey, Paul Krugman, where the hell are you, man? Your country needs you now.
It's a fun little tune. You should give it a listen. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 1.5%, 115 points, closed at 7,660. The NASDAQ lost 2.3%, 37 points, finished at 1518. The S&P 500 slid 1.75%, 14 points, ended the day at 806. Thanks today to Jennifer Collins, Renita Jablonski, and Doug Krisner on our morning report crew. Coming up next time on this radio broadcast, we pay a visit to the city that Credit built, Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
The Wells Fargo building, CNA, Bank of the West on my right, First National Bank on my left, and in my rearview mirror, I can see First Bank and Trust.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.